Simply having wonderful Game of Thrones. No,
wonderful Christmas time.
I hate this Christmas song. This is my least favorite Christmas carol. And I want all of our listeners to have it stuck in their heads now.
We're so glad to be together this Christmas / holiday / politically correct week. Welcome to Game of Thrones.
Thank you.
Welcome.
For welcoming me.
It's good to be here. Good to be back, guys.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, Eric, welcome.
Thanks for coming back, Eric. Glad you're here. How was we already know. We just recorded it for the Patreon stuff.
Well, thank you for recording in the state of Pennsylvania when you could record in the state of Illinois.
Yes, I'm far from the trains of the Chicago Transit Authority. They can't get me here.
That's what you think.
That's a challenge. That's a challenge.
I'm going to take the train sound from one of our episodes and put it in.
And just put it in the background. Yeah.
Sorry, listeners. We love you.
Or that you're joining us. Furnace.
Absolutely.
Or heater. I'm sorry.
We know that this is a special week for all of you listening, whether you're at home or whether for some reason your employer or you've done this to yourself are still working, as it's almost time for everyone to stop working, even Walmart.
Ooh.
You know, I respect that, though. I think there's something to be said for that.
But we won't. All right? We're still coming at you this week.
Yeah. We're spending Christmas at Craster's.
Yeah. Christmas?
Oh.
Jingle
are
bells,
we?
Jingle bells. Deck the halls with Craster's daughters.
Oh.
Oh. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Eric is just... Eric,
you and Clubfoot Carl, man.
You have a little eggnog before you recorded?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What?
With some rum?
No rum.
Food and fire is all I
there
need.
There might be rum. I haven't looked.
No, in the eggnog, though.
Oh, no. No eggnog.
Spiced eggnog. No. Spiked eggnog.
I actually saw, I follow Makers on Facebook, Maker's Mark, and they gave an eggnog recipe that I'd actually try. It was like, it involved an egg. And yeah.
Did it
clearly that's
nog?
How you make eggnog.
Last night, I had Yamazaki 12-year. Like scotch, Japanese scotch, whiskey, whatever. It's not really scotch. It's not from Scotland, but it's like single malt Japanese whiskey.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there was some like big worldwide scotch competition that usually Scottish whiskeys win, but Yamazaki won this year and all of Scotland is angry or whatever. And so I had it last night.
Yeah.
And
it was it was smoother than Micah Tannenbaum's voice.
Oh, girl. But was it lighter than a stout?
No.
Okay. If you haven't noticed, of all these in-jokes we have, we've released our third chapter on Patreon recently.
Yeah.
We're all having a good laugh.
Yay.
I'm jealous of your warmth, your beverage warmth. I've been dealing with the cool coldness and this handle of coffee that I just downed. So I don't know about you guys, but I'm very, very excited to do these chapters. I was just like, I literally, when I finished them today before our recording, I go, damn. I literally exclaimed out loud, damn, like this is okay. This was a good group of chapters, perfect for our Christmas week, Christmas at Craster's.
I'm glad you said that. This really is a good, like these are good. This is a good set of chapters for Christmas.
You think so?
Yeah.
It really captures the spirit.
Really? It does. Well, maybe a Game of Thrones Christmas.
Yeah, Game of Thrones Christmas. Here we go with Christmas at Craster's first. You've got Craster and his family, right? Isn't that what we do at the holidays? We bring our family together.
Breaking bread. Mm-hmm. Only two loaves of
for
bread.
Better or for worse, Craster's with all of his family there. And as always, the family erupts into an argument and different factions split off and do different things. So there's that. And then Arya's chapter is a bit like getting your Christmas present that you've always wanted, which is the Hound on trial. But once you get it, do you really want it anymore? And will it run away from you or whatever? So I think that this is a good Christmas set of chapters.
Eric, you had a troubled childhood. You want to tell us about it? He's like, I'm at my childhood home and it's bringing back all of these dark, dark, dark memories.
Only Eric could paint that amazing picture. Which,
oh, thank you.
By the way, before we jumped into recording the actual chapters here, I just wanted to let you know we were talking about scotch earlier. And this man... At lunch yesterday, he was sipping on some serious liqueur there.
Yeah.
Oh, this man. Oh, meaning me.
You didn't tell
I
me.
Had like you, a, yeah.
No.
I was drinking Coca-Cola.
You were drinking
You guys
Coca-Cola.
Had lunch yesterday?
We went. We had lunch together. We went to Tiernanog, which is this old haunt, old Irish pub.
Aww.
It was, I had like a Macallan like 10-year, though. It was not like a super.
That is some Highlands whiskey right there.
That's some nice stuff. Mm. Yeah.
I like it.
It's nice, but it was only 10. They had an 18 that I didn't go for.
Only 10. Listen to our world. 10. This is only 10 years. Who would have
broke the bank at 18? No, but
I impressed Micah, and that was nice. Yeah, it was like, I can't go to an Irish pub now and just get like a cider. Like, first of all, because Magners cider is usually all they stock, and Magners is a bad cider. Like, it just smells like ass.
Also because you're trying to grow facial hair.
I am trying to. You know what? It's working. I feel like as my scotch intake has increased, so too has the frequency of me shaving. Yeah, Kate, you should see. I have right now, I missed a spot, and it's like a centimeter long now, and I missed it. Like, it's really like, my beard hair has grown a lot now.
It was great just
Merry Christmas.
Watching his girlfriend when he was going back and forth with the waitress. She actually brought him over a list of scotch.
Yeah. Uh-huh. This woman did not know what scotches they stocked. It was unbelievable.
But meanwhile, it was an Irish pub.
Unbelievable.
It was an Irish pub. Yeah. And she came back twice. I forget. Like one time she was just like, did you say you wanted scotch? I'm like, yeah, I want scotch.
Also bangers and mash, stat, pronto. Yeah,
they had like 12 different kinds. So like, I understand why she couldn't remember, but also she looked at me like I had two heads when I asked for scotch.
Because she probably thought you were 13 years old.
Yeah. Well, she didn't card me, so.
I don't know about that facial hair, pal.
But it was nice having a nice lunch. Actually, we all ordered the same thing. Me, my girlfriend, and Micah all ordered the corned beef, as you do.
Mm.
Was it good?
It was great.
It was good.
A preview
they put in they put in horseradish though, which I guess is common, but I'm never quite prepared.
It's usually sauerkraut.
I'm never quite prepared for the rush that eating horseradish brings
it
on.
Clears your sinuses.
It affects me. It affects my brain. It's like brain freeze. It might be what you're saying, but
could have been the whiskey.
It's like a brain freeze that happens, but like it's a horseradish drawn. Like I've just gotten something crazy that's like opening my pores up, the pores of my mind.
I'm glad you don't do drugs, pal.
Yeah. Me too. Me as well.
That horseradish.
Well, I apologize for taking us on that tangent.
Yeah, no, it's Christmas.
I didn't know you had lunch yesterday. I'm really jealous.
Oh, we didn't.
We should have taken a picture.
We didn't take any photos this weekend.
Why didn't you take a picture of your lunching with two empty chairs and say, we miss you guys?
Then Zach can feel the overwhelming guilt that I felt the last time you guys did that.
I have a picture of Micah and me, but it's doctored so that Micah's included because
I missed the Friday night festivities.
He missed the Friday night festivities. So Andrew and Kevin from MuggleCast were both in town on Friday. Micah wasn't feeling well, so he couldn't make it. But just to make them jealous, we left later and they both went home. And I texted them a selfie of the rest of the group with Micah and saying, hey, Micah came out after all. And Kevin texted back and he was like, he hates this, doesn't he?
Oh, I'm jelly.
But it was actually the selfie with Zach and me and Christian and Zach, or and Micah with that I doctored in to look like Micah. So all things come around to goo in the end.
In the end,
we will probably talk about Game of Thrones in this podcast today.
It's Christmas chapter.
Yeah,
it's
our gift for you.
So let's get back to Christmas at Craster's.
Ding, 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 ding. We should put our song in here, Micah, and just overlay it.
Grab the guitar. Let's go again for round two.
No, please. We have to write a whole new verse.
We would.
Remind me, I am sort of spacing.
Did you read the right chapter?
I did. Is this the first Sam chapter where he grows wings and flies away like a dragon? Or has this happened before?
This is it.
Oh, I read the wrong chapter. My question was, is this the first Sam chapter since the intro?
It's his second of the book.
So we've finally seen the what happened after they fled and Small Paul helped him.
This is our first sort of, you know, especially with John having been there and having been with Mance and them seeing the destruction and devastation that had happened and us not knowing the fate of these people, this is kind of our first like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now this is what's happened. And now we can kind of take stats to see who is still alive, which I was really happy to see that Ed and Gren and the whole crew is still around. Yeah. So pretty good.
This is like a serious business chapter too,
mm-hmm.
because this is a lot of stuff happens in this chapter.
Yeah.
It gets a little tense. You see like a pretty well done
turkey.
No, that's the fallen warrior.
You see a pretty well done description of men becoming desperate. It's not like these men, Carl became desperate and lashed out. Like you see just like hints of this desperation as the chapter goes on until we get to the end of it or near the end when it just all hell breaks loose. Like they're hungry. They're seeing this man abuse his wives and daughters and having to listen to Gilly loudly give birth, and everybody's on edge because this is not something that they've had to get used to. It's just this, and I remember this being really well done in the show and feeling like this was all fantastic there too, even though it was a very different set of characters, I think. Mm-hmm. And the way that they told it in the show was quite different. But this tension is so good, and Craster is such a D-hole. And what? He is like
a dill hole.
You're so Eric. A dill hole. Yeah. A dillweed. And you're so excited. I was so excited when they kill Craster.
Oh man.
But I know that was probably not a great thing for Mormont. Like, it's just like, okay, well, that was rude, you guys.
Oh, please and then stop.
They're like, hey, here's what we think of your judgment about our rudeness. And then they stab him. And then she just goes crazy. Goes insane. 100% bananas.
Let's talk about going 100% bananas, because there's like a lapse in, it's not really amnesia, but there is in this chapter something that doesn't always occur in a George R. R. Martin chapter, which is that he manages to skip ahead. He actually missed the absolute worst of the action. After Mormont dies, Sam like wakes up a little bit later with the dying Mormont in his lap after, and then summarizes. And it was an interesting technique because ultimately he did portray this loss of order within the Night's Watch. And that was like the excitement of the chapter. And then in the end, all you're left with are these corpses. And, you know, some people made off into the woods. Other people tried and failed to go after some of the girls. And the others are actually in the basement, where Craster did in fact have more foods and rations. And I don't know if I blame him for keeping food for himself. I
mean, that's a great question to kind of throw around here, is because, you know, these are guests of Craster. He doesn't have to entertain them at all. Mm-hmm. If he chooses not to. And he may be a little skimpy on his rations that he's providing, but he is giving them food
and shelter
enough to sustain. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And shelter. Yeah. Absolutely. They may not like the conditions under which Craster allows them to stay within his keep, but if they don't like it, they can leave. And while you're sympathetic, certainly, to the situation that the Night's Watch are in, and you certainly wouldn't mind seeing a person like Craster get killed for what he is and what he has done to all of his wives, there's also that rule of hospitality, right? You're right. Under somebody's roof. And this is very much foreshadowing to the Red Wedding and the idea that once you break bread with somebody, you know, they are your guest. Whether they like you or you like them, you are to show them certain courtesies and certain respects until they are no longer your guest. Mm-hmm. And the Night's Watch certainly doesn't do that. And they do it under the pretense of the fact that there are no real rules that exist beyond the wall.
You know, I wanted to contrast that idea that Craster is obligated to, you know, basically tolerate these men, and they're obligated to tolerate him, with this sense of duty that Sam feels. It's true that very few men of the Night's Watch are in fact knights, but there's a quote I grabbed from the chapter that Sam is talking about. I guess he's fantasizing about saving Gilly or running away with her, especially after she births what turns out to be a boy. He says knights are supposed to defend women and children. You know, so this is the issue with Craster beating up on these women. Like, the men of the Night's Watch, they took vows just like knights did. Should they be protecting these women? Should they, like, by killing Craster, are they behaving knightly, you know, in doing that?
Yeah, this is definitely an issue that we have addressed before, and I think that it's probably the same answer for me. Like, in this case, which is a very strange case, Lord Commander Mormont has taken their situation and kind of put it ahead of their policing duty. You know, the way they handle normal wildlings is certainly a lot different than they handle Craster and his wives. So I think that just having that difference right off the bat, and getting what they've gotten in return from Craster, and the sort of mutual respect they've built out of fear in a lot of different ways. You got kind of fear on one side and pity on the other. It's just created a relationship between the two establishments that is not okay, and it is not normal by any stretch of the imagination. So I don't think there's really lots of ways we can judge this, because it's a mutual agreement basically between two of the leading members of two parties, which in this case is Mormont and Craster. And as you can see, when that goes astray, it all falls apart. Like the House mm-hmm. of Cards completely is unraveled.
Mm-hmm. It's also a matter of respect, and you could tell that Craster does not hold anybody, even the Lord Commander at times, with any regard at all. His respect is only to himself, because he doesn't even respect those that are his wives / daughters.
He's proud. He has this fierce pride. I think the thing with Mormont...
Well, he calls himself a godly
man.
Yeah,
which is bullshit. Well, it depends on who your god is, right? If your gods are those whites that come, then he's a very godly man. Who knows how many boys he's sacrificed over the years, which we learn more about at the
very end. He's a godly man, yeah, who protects himself mm-hmm. by sacrificing his son. So how godly is
he? Yeah, his tizzy with Mormont is that he doesn't like being called a bastard. He doesn't like when the men are calling him names. Mormont asks for silence and thinks that that will end it. But Craster is so offended that he really insists on attacking, was it Carl?
He's supremely prideful at the moment because they need him, and he realizes that. And at the end of the day, he's got this compound of many-wived compound where he probably does have scores of all the delicious things described in this chapter buried underneath the ground, waiting for him to consume and waiting for his family to consume. And because of the pact that he struck with the White Walkers, or whatever that situation ends up being, he has remained safe. And the Wildlings have also, Mance Rayder has also, and you know, communicated with him. They have a relationship as well. And so when you think about it, this guy does have a lot to be proud of, that he's been able to pull off north of the wall. He's got kind of a comfortable existence, no matter how much of a shithead he is. And when they are disgracing him and disrespecting him so hard, right in his own hall, his pride got the best of him and he acted like an idiot. And then, mm-hmm. like what normally happens when pride gets the best of you, something bad happened.
I mean, Craster, kind of going off of that, Craster even mentioned that Mance Rayder has been there, was kind of looking around, assessing the situation, and that there was some kind of, not misunderstanding, but Mance didn't even really understand what was really going on there. He kind of just passed by. And it's interesting that Mance, who also is forced to live north of the wall, or chooses to live north of the wall, carves a much different future out for himself than the one that Craster has had. But actually, I wanted to talk about Sam here, because Sam is so different from...
It's his chapter, damn it.
It's his chapter, but also it's he's so different from any of the other men that we have the fortune of knowing through Sam's eyes. But he's just so different. He doesn't like... He's got a cool name now, right? Ever since the last chapter, when he's slain the White... He's being called Sam the Slayer.
White Walker.
Finally, we get to like White have Walker. That in canon, right?
Yeah.
Sam Slayer. The Slayer.
Hey,
which is
Slayer.
Awesome.
He doesn't relish it, though. He doesn't like this at all. He says it was...
Yeah, he knows they're making fun of
him. Yeah.
He thinks, but are they? Look, it's a cool
yes,
name.
Definitely.
It's a badass
oh,
name.
They it's super cool, but they're like smirking at him and laughing at him and telling him like, hey, Slayer, why don't you come fire this arrow?
Slayer, I know you didn't shoot the guy with an arrow, but we still want to see you shoot, buddy. Get
we
over
totally
here.
I totally want to see you shoot, because they know that he sucks at shooting arrows. And he's like, no, guys, please leave me alone.
This is brought up in this chapter. Is it not better than Sir Piggy? Is it not better than
Listen,
Sir Piggy?
Listen, absolutely right.
It's much better than that.
First off, can I just say, I love this chapter. I loved it. I had so many notes taken, probably more than I've taken throughout the whole read of this book so far, before we even got to the dinner scene and the breakdown. I didn't even know that was going to be in this chapter, because I thought the chapter was so rich leading up to that point. But like, he had a great conversation with Grin, and the whole time he's regretting that it's not John. And he's like, Grin's great. He's not really as dumb as Ed makes him seem. And like, it was fun. But that moment where they were telling him to come shoot arrows, I just thought, George R. R. Martin, you clever, clever man. Within all of the stuff that's happening, he's got Sam stepping into the mud, which could be Craster's shit, Ed says.
Could be.
We've all seen thick mud. He gets his boot stuck in the mud, and he walks and his socks hanging out. You know, we've all had that happen when we were kids, maybe, or maybe a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Not saying. But, like, have to put such an embarrassing, hilarious moment in the midst of what's happening. Just, I don't know. It really gives the chapter such a really fun dynamic mingled with all the badness. I just thought it was great.
He just doesn't want the recognition. I think that's what it is deep down. He just doesn't want any attention drawn to him, good or bad.
Right.
Because I think there's the expectation that he's going to have to rise to the occasion again. And who knows if he can actually do that. Mm. And he still acts a bit craven in this chapter. He's whiny. He's upset that everybody's calling him Sam the Slayer. And, you know, I likened it a bit, though, to Thorne always calling John Lord Snow, you know, like, or Bastard, you know, like, these are the nicknames that are given to characters who are actually of strength. Like Sir Piggy, not as much, obviously, but Slayer is not a bad name to have.
You can easily see Slayer up there with the other names that Ulmer in particular,
Iron Maiden,
mentions. Yeah, like Fletcher Dick, who's this awesome, you know, Fletcher of age, and these this band of outlaws. I mentioned their names: Simon Toyne, the Smiling Wend Knight,
Fawn.
Yeah, Wend of the White Fawn, Oswin Longneck, the Thrice Hanged. You know, Sam the Slayer is not that far from there. Like they're gonna tell if Sam does get a few more adventures, whether or not he wants them. His name will be Sam the Slayer, and it will go down in history.
Not too bad.
He's done something that, as far as we know, hasn't been done in thousands of years.
Yeah, and
that is kill a White
Mormont
Walker. And
says as much. It's really interesting. He's just like, we have forgotten not only that this could be done, but like we've forgotten what our true purpose is. You know, when you break it down, he says to Sam, like, these wildlings are just men. They're just other men. But, you know, this wall, you don't erect a 700-foot wall to keep mere men out. Like, his conversation in particular with Sam is an interesting one because they have two of them. One, when they're just like Mormont first arrives at Craster's or returns to Craster's. And, you know, then again, when he's laying dying, he entrusts Sam then. But the first time he's just like, stop whining, shut your mouth and come with me. Like you keep.
Yeah. Do you have a brother here by the same name?
Like, get over here.
I was going to say, can we not gloss over that entrance by.
Oh, yeah. Like, I loved it. It was going to be my own.
I actually have it down as an own. I'm not going to use it as an own because I have, I think, seven things down as my own.
Awesome.
We're of the same mind, though, Zach. We are.
Can I, you want to read it for your own? We'll make wait. I just want to, it's so badass. Please.
Where he goes, who in the seven hells do you think goes here?
All right. So he just rolls in and we don't know he's alive yet. So this is kind of cool. He says, Mormont swung down from the saddle, jolting his raven back into the air. He saw Sam then and bellowed, Tarly! And he's like, me? Sam got awkwardly to his feet. And the raven's like, me! So just imagine Lord Commander Mormont rolling in, and he's got a raven that's mocking Sam, right? The raven landed on the old man's head, me? And he goes, is your name Tarly? Do you have a brother hereabouts? Yes, you. Close your mouth and come with me. I just thought, like, dude, what a way to roll in. Just getting off his saddle and shouting Sam's name. Like, you're the guy who killed stuff. Come over here. Just what an entrance.
Sam refuses to take credit. His quote that I have from him is, it was the dragonglass that slew it, not me, the dragonglass, talking about the White Walker. He's like, he does refuse the recognition. And I think it's for the same reasons that Kate was mentioning, too, that he just doesn't want to be called upon to do it again.
It wasn't me, it was my wand.
My wand acted of its own accord.
But again, that goes back to him not being accountable for things that he did that are actually good. Like, he doesn't want the spotlight shown on him at all. And he needs to be a little bit more... No, sorry, he needs to be less humble. He's too humble.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
He's like, he should be like, I'm Samwell fucking Tarly. I slew a White Walker.
Legend.
I'm the legend of, no, that's the
Craster's
other guy.
Keep. Yeah. But no, I see the comparison. Yeah, some people
You want me to shoot an arrow? Bend over and I'll shoot it right up your ass.
Got any more zingers,
Michael? Probably.
Can you say that in the Sam voice?
No, don't. Don't comply.
You should totally.
I like stories like this within Game of Thrones, because to me, this is the kind of thing that their great, great grandchildren, three generations down the line, will tell the story of Sam the Slayer and how brave he was. And he slew a White Walker with the dragonglass dagger. And that's the whole story. The rest of it, the fear and the cowardice and the fact that he was hugely overweight and everything that he sees negative about himself won't matter. All that matters is the story, the name and the story and the legend and like the pure distilled elements of what he did to change the world, essentially.
Yeah.
And I like thinking about that. I like thinking that Sam's legend will be deserving of him as a person.
He may be called like Sam the Reminder. He reminded everyone how to really like how to fight this war, how to win this war.
I love that though, Kate. That's one of my favorite parts of this whole series, because I know that what's happening now is probably fated, and we're living in that fate. So it's easy to glorify all the stuff of the past, you know, the dragons and Robert's Rebellion and the tales that we learned during Duncan Egg and from Duncan Egg that was even more further in the past for them.
Yeah.
But now we're living in the fated time, and this is a legend. Sam the Slayer did kill the White Walker, and he did remind the Night's Watch and the people up north how to kill them again. And in this chapter, we were getting the question asked by the old bear that we've been asking ourselves for so long, which is, how do we get more dragon glass? And it's just, I don't know, it was just, it felt so good. It was fun.
Find the dragons. You know, it's kind of ironic that he asks that question, yet his son is the one with the woman who actually has the dragons.
Yeah. That is. Wow, that's funny. Jor gets a shout out in this chapter, which I thought was
awesome. He does.
I got chills.
Which, this was not in the show.
Why would they take this out of the show if it's not going to, like, if it's going to actually pan out? That's what I wanted to see.
I know that it got mentioned from time to time, probably both by Jorah and by the Lord Commander, but I don't know that they ever really established sort of that father-son relationship. Mm. Like, I feel like it was mentioned in passing. I don't know it would have been as impactful.
I know I had to remember. I had to be told that Jorah and Old Bear were related the first time when we were going through either after the first season or something, because it wasn't like I didn't pick it up. So it's definitely not like doted on at all. But with Mormont's dying breaths, I couldn't help but kind of inflect or reflect that maybe where the show Jorah, like where his path may lie in the future. Show Jorah having just left Dany's service, presumably for good because he's banished. But I thought, well, what if he makes his way north the way that Stannis and Melisandre did? Like, how would Jorah... I don't think he'd have it in his heart to just defend against White Walkers. I think his heart is pretty much stuck with Dany. But it'd be interesting to see his player.
Definitely. This was just overall such a interesting chapter, though, because you really get a taste for Beyond the Wall and the types of people who live there. I know Craster is just one example, but I think you go from one extreme to the other. You know, we've been, you know, along with the Bloody Mummers, and then, you know, we're with Arya, who's with the Brotherhood Without Banners, and the, everything that they bear witness to, sort of the harsh conditions, and now we're beyond the wall with a group of people who are cold, they're starving. Each faction is dealing with the realities of war, but they're so contrasted. They're none of them that we see are the same. They're all kind of dealing with their own issues, and Craster, he's just such a pig, man. He even compares his daughter's giving birth to a sow giving birth to her little piglets
without a grunt.
Yeah. And yet this is somebody who proclaims himself to be a godly man.
Right.
A man who sacrifices his sons, who, you know, at the end, you know, we learn from his wives, who, and I actually forgot about this, they mentioned that the boy's brothers will take him, you know, referring to Gilly's son who had just been born earlier in the chapter. If they don't get Gilly to safety and her son, that the boy's brothers will come. And I think that may shed a little bit more light onto who we saw in the, season four.
This is huge. Yeah. This is absolutely.
And I, for as a book reader, I did not remember this. Kate, I don't know if you did.
I mean, I just kind of assumed it though, right? I mean, they had to have gone somewhere.
Well, it's like, how did it start? You know, how did it start? Like with Craster and the first boy could not have been taken by that boy's brothers. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, I'm sure that whatever those folks were doing up there was probably a couple of them. And maybe they've just been repowering over time.
Yeah. But I love that somehow Craster's sisters or wives, daughters, whatever they are, have knowledge of this, have knowledge of the idea that these boys that he's leaving in the woods grow up and become these reapers.
They've got to know, though, after being there for so long.
But it's like, think about, oh my God, think about like all of these girls though that are in Craster's. There's an equal amount, say, because, you know, the gender divide is like 50-50, more like 55-45. But anyway, you know, there's an equal amount of boys just sitting up in the north somewhere. You know, just like Craster's Keep is filled with all those women, there's an equal amount of men who have been turned into White Walkers just waiting to do whatever it is that they're, you know, doing. It's a scary thought.
Yeah. And probably more.
Yeah.
This is the only arrangement.
Yeah, that's what I was always figuring, is that Craster's just contributing. It's not like they're like, well, Craster's incestuous offspring are the only perfect, like,
the seed is strong with Craster.
Something about his seed is strong.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's, it seems, I agree with that, with Zach on this. It's just a contribution to an existing army. Mm-hmm. And there are probably lots of little outposts like this where they've figured out that if you give the White Walkers your children, they'll leave you alone.
I mean, is it just boys? Is it, why do they only take the boys?
Well, I don't know if they only take the boys or if Craster only gives the boys. It seems like Craster is just like very interested in
his wives.
Banging his daughters. Yeah. So
that's interesting.
I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, this is a precarious situation because I know that the Lord Commander Mormont is dead and that the civil unrest is spread like wildfire in this place. I just thought the way it happened, the way that their shouting happened at the dinner, the way it kind of started with food and it just got so petty and deconstructed from there. Like I said, I didn't see it coming and it was brutal. Craster's neck was slit. The old bear was stabbed in the stomach. And then, like you said, Eric, we had that gap of time where things kind of went out and we didn't know what happened. I'm interested to see what Sam ends up doing in the book with Gilly and how far they're able to go. And I'm also glad that people like Gren were able to escape the Blackest Crows, as they were called, while they were getting their jollies off in X amount of ways. So, yeah, it's going to be cool. I'm excited.
Yep. Sam's on the run.
Sam is on the run. I wish we had more Sam chapters. This was just
yeah.
I know. Only two so far, and we're how many chapters into this book already?
Now I'm looking at into the future. I want to see how many more Sam chapters there are.
Don't read the spoilers.
I'm not going to read spoilers, but in general.
There are things that are coming that weren't in the show. So buckle up, boys.
Actually, there's, okay. There are three more Sam chapters in this book.
I'm right, Kate. Am I right?
You're right.
I'm excited. Well, what was in the show was, of course, them burning their dead brother, which I wanted to talk about, because there's that line.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, if he smelled so sweet, like, if we had applesauce, I'd cut a piece off of him, because pork goes great with applesauce. It's crazy, like, it's a crazy thought, and it was conveyed well in the show, but it's just, like, these men are that desperate. You know, they're talking, and they're having to bear witness to this brother being incinerated as a result of, you know, trying to prevent him from changing into one of these monsters, and having to deal with the smell, because it's cooking meat at the end of the day. It smells like a feast to them, something that they would very much love, but it's their brother. It's crazy that George writes about this sort of stuff all the time, like these terrible things that are becoming realities to these people.
I thought that the adaptation of this funeral scene was excellent. I don't think it was exactly this funeral scene, but the way Lord Commander was like, his name was Bannon. And he's like, he was a brave man, a good ranger. He came to us from, where did he come from? Down White Harbor way. And he's like, he came to us from White Harbor.
Never told a lie. Always just crossed his T's and dotted his I's.
Exactly. Yeah. George was able to input this in kind of a really somber moment inside of a really somber chapter that still had just the lightest edge of humor to it. It was nice.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
I also liked the continuing resolution from the prologue, where really we get the plan that was formulated to kill the Lord Commander, and it doesn't come to fruition, obviously, because they're attacked. And then two Sam chapters later, unfortunately, the Lord Commander meets his end. So even though their plan didn't work, obviously there were still some amongst the Night's Watch that were willing to take out Mormont and not think twice about it, because really now they're all free agents. We assume some will go back to the Wall, but others that are, as you mentioned, Zach, sort of the blackest of the crows, who knows what they're going to do. You know, they'll do what's in their own best interest, I would assume.
This is why there are craft services on every film set. You have to keep people fed well. Otherwise,
shit
will happen. Yeah, it'll be mutinous. Yeah. It'll be terrible. We've all seen Treasure Island, even with the Muppets. It's
even if these men do go back to the wall, there's the John chapter previously where we know that some wildlings have already beaten them to the wall. Like, this is the time where, after having scaled the wall, it's like, what will we find at the wall? It's like, the wall is not a refuge anymore. The wall is something that has been attacked or invaded. And it's just not with this growing unease as a subplot of this book between how the men that are north of the wall are never coming back to the same home, or the home is safe. The home is not safe anymore for them. So, like, nowhere they go is good. Yeah, nowhere they go is going to be good for them.
No. And Sam is going into really dangerous territory between Craster's Keep and the wall, because he doesn't know what's there. It could be wildlings, could be White Walkers, could be whites. And is he well equipped? You know, is he going to grab some of that dragon glass before he hightails it out of there?
We did get an inventory of exactly how much dragon glass the watch has.
Yep, we did. On them.
Some of its arrowheads.
More than I needed to know, to be honest with you.
There will be a test at the end of this episode, listeners.
The devil is in the details.
All right, multiple choice.
An old broken horn.
Yes,
by the way.
I took a note. Damn it. All right. I was
yes. Egret mentioned a horn.
Uh-huh. I was like,
just a few chapters ago.
Oh, snap.
In the drawer, there was a dusty locket. And I'm like, bullshit, there's just a dusty locket. I called that before 6 came out. And I'm calling this. Said there'd been dagger blades and spearheads, 200 or 300 arrowheads at least. John had made daggers for himself, Sam, and Lord Commander Mormont. And he'd given Sam a spearhead and an old broken horn.
Oh, mend the horn.
So I know that Kate and Micah, you guys aren't of the mind to spoil it for our listeners and us. But I just want to say I'm calling it right now. I think it's something rather than nothing.
Lucky that Sam should happen upon that cash.
Confirmed. Yeah, sure.
It's a Christmas miracle. What do you think, Eric? You think it's something?
Hell yeah.
Yeah?
Card.
Let's connect the horn.
Card.
To the hound.
Yeah, this is another crazy chapter. We got two in a row. This is why this book is my favorite, because it's just like every single chapter. For I feel like the last 2 or 3 weeks that we've been doing this podcast, have been like, these are major chapters, mm-hmm. but it's just one after another, all this crazy, crazy shit that happens. Storm of Swords is a serious business book.
It is. You guys weren't kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're definitely not. I love the way this is adapted into the show. It made for a great episode. Was it Kissed by Fire? Was Brian Cogman's episode?
I believe it was Kissed by Fire.
Yeah. It was made for a great episode of the show. Here's the corresponding chapter in the book. And while some things are different, I think it's really just enjoyable in both cases how the Hound is, kind of treating his captivity. And these men that have captured him, first of all, it's revealed to be Sandor Clegane. Arya is the point of view character who's witnessing this. And these men really want justice for all of these other people that were killed by the Lannisters. And they're looking to the Hound to be that whipping...
Scape hound.
Can I just compare this a little bit to Craster as well? Because I think that, Sandor, for all of his misgivings, and he has a whole long list of them, mm-hmm. I don't know that it's fair, to necessarily criticize him for what others have done and make him sort of the...
Scape hound.
The Scape Hound. Yeah, I like that. Because when I mentioned comparing it to Craster, we talked about with the last chapter how, was it really fair of the Night's Watch to do what they did to Craster, being under his roof, having basically being guests of his? Mm-hmm. And I think you could argue it probably either way, that Craster was a terrible person. Who cares? They're beyond the wall. There's no rules there. But at the same time, you have to respect the fact that it's the man's home, right. Mm-hmm. And he is treating you with a certain level of courtesy. So there is that whole blurred line, and we can discuss either side of it as many times as we want. I think it's the same thing with the Hound.
Okay.
He's a terrible person. We know this, despite his charming nature on the show, which we enjoyed watching with Arya, at least his wit and satire. But is it fair to really all these crimes, a lot of which we learn about in this chapter were crimes that his brother committed on his shoulders, and make him really defend a lot of what the Lannisters and the Lannister men have done to the part of the kingdom that they are in.
I'm glad you brought this up. We know that the Hound and Arya have this beautiful journey ahead of them in the because of the show. But right now we have to look back at, you know, who is this Hound guy? What do we know of him so far? And looking back to, you know, he left. He chose to leave right before the Battle of Blackwater. He chose to leave the Lannisters and go out on his own. And so we see kind of the payoff of that, which is now he's able to say, like, I was their hand, but I didn't do nearly any of this, any of this stuff that you're accusing me of. And he has a real defense. Like, basically what you're saying, Mike, about how, you know, is it really right to justify the punishment of him for all of these crimes that his brother or other people under the Lannisters committed? That's his whole argument. And the Thoros of Myr and Beric Dondarrion and everyone else in the cave knows that, you know, after he protests, that it's a pretty weak argument, which is where Arya, our heroine, our point of view character, comes in, because she's able to pin the murder of Micah on him. And that is what these men, these 30 odd people, men and women, I should say, choose to like put him on trial for, is this one murder of this one boy who was clearly nothing in the grand scheme of like, of all these other, like, you know, knights and soldiers and people that were killed that they're trying to avenge. They decide that they have a case in this Micah thing, that they choose to pursue, which is, it's interesting that kind of their plans are able to still proceed, but not in the way that they expect.
I thought this was bullshit.
Go on.
I was like,
was it Hound shit?
I was like, what are you doing, guys? You know, we've been traveling with you, and I understand that the Hound is a pretty good steal, but I think Sandor puts it best in this chapter. I don't have the quote highlighted, but he was like, I was drunk, got it. Your hounds came and got me. You stole all of my shit, and now you're putting me in a cave saying you're going to kill me for stuff that my big brother did, who is a guaranteed privileged asshole that no one likes, including me. He put me in the fire. Have you seen my face? I quit my job.
Have you seen my face? Have you seen my face?
And you're literally naming off all the people that you knew, and the people that they knew as well, that were killed by Lannister men. When I was a Lannister man, because I needed a full-time job. You guys also used to work for the kingdom. Do you remember?
Yeah.
There's a different king now. And it's just, he had all these really great points. And of course, he did murder Micah. But even for that, he had a great point. He was like, the prince, who I am sworn to by life or death, said that it happened. And then also the older sister, who wasn't yelling and screaming and kicking, said that it happened as well. And then the king told me to go do something. So I did. Or someone did, or something, you know, or the prince did. Either way, he had some kind of a royal thing that told him to go do that terrible thing to that butcher boy, which was completely stupid.
Even though he was kind of a dick about it at the end to Arya.
Yeah, no, he was such an asshole. But that's his situation. He's like, this is bullshit. You guys are putting me up to this. And that's why, Eric, they had to put him on trial for the deal with Micah, because at the end of the day, that's the only real solid accusation that they had. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think the Lord of Light chose correctly.
Like, the reason Arya like hates him so much is because he enjoyed running down Micah. He enjoyed running down that boy. And that's what gets her. That's what she can't, you know, get over. Is that, like, it was the king's orders, but you enjoyed it and you deserve to die because you're a mean man. And like, she's not quite at that point where she can see both sides of Sandor, or really anybody. She doesn't really process, like, Beric lost a lot of weight, or was it Thoros? You know, everybody's kind of both, changed in front of her. Yeah, they both look way different than the last time she saw them, and she's not, I don't think she's quite grasping the depth that some of these characters have. But Sandor in particular, she's really angry, and I mean, this is why she wants him dead to begin with, why she recites his name every night before she goes to bed, is because of this long-standing grudge as a result of this terrible thing that he did to Micah. But really, like, apart from killing him, it was that he enjoyed killing him. And is that Sandor's fault? Like, is that a bad thing? Should your hired mercenary hate every minute of every kill that he completes because it's morally wrong to kill? I mean, no, he was ordered to, so should he not take pleasure in his work?
I think that his... Obviously, and we learn about it through the show, and I'm sure we'll learn about it throughout the book's prose when the Hound becomes a larger character, less on the run. But he is so brutish and prideful and firm, and he doesn't crack. He doesn't let a lot out. He's a locked box, and he hides behind this surly demeanor and these sharp tongued words, and it works for him. You know, it keeps him from getting his feelings out there, and it pisses off of the people surrounding him. You know, you see a lot of captives in the story, but you don't see a lot of captives that can have more power than everybody else in the entire room while he's being captured. I mean, he's just really commanding a presence here among all of these people in their own little tree city. It takes a lot
Tyrion
to do that.
At the Vale, isn't it?
They're different characters, but I guess the same fate was. That's an interesting way to put it. There's no Bronn here. We just have the Hound's own spirit and tenacity.
Yeah, I was thinking what you're saying though about the characters being like charismatic enough to like get a word in, you know, and kind of affect the events that come upon them. Sandor nearly gets out of it. If Arya hadn't been there, you know, to really bring that up, they may have had to let him go to begin with. But a part of what I wanted to ask, you know, going back to what I said about Sandor enjoying it, is that, of course, he does eventually, although it's a hard-fought battle, he wins. And what does that mean in terms of, this was a trial judged, you know, we're meant to believe, by the Lord of Light, and the Lord of Light chose to allow Sandor to win or Sandor to live. What does this mean? Does the Lord of Light now have a thing against Micah, innocent little, you know, farm boys? Like, what is the implication there that because Sandor win, is he innocent? Because we know he actually killed that boy, and Sandor himself knows that he killed that boy, but he won. So what does it mean?
It means that the pretense for the fight is bullshit. I mean, for lack of a better term, I'm sorry. My language, I know this is a G-rated podcast.
Is it?
Sure is.
G for gore, guts, and all other G-related things. But I don't think that Sandor winning the fight does anything more than prove that he is a good soldier. Like, he knows how to fight. And he beat Beric fair and square. And there is no sort of underhandedness about it. If anything, I thought Beric tried to be a bit...
Wily.
Yeah, by fighting with fire and knowing that was one thing, the only thing really, that would put the Hound back on his heels a bit. And still, the Hound was able to prevail. So I think that says a lot for him. And sorry if this was brought up before, but who...
who?
My dog's staring at me.
He's gonna like lunge at you in a second because he thinks you're
an owl.
Yeah. who? No. So the question I had though, as it relates to the Brotherhood Without Banners, is who are they really to judge him? You know, who made them the jury in all of this?
They did.
I know, but really. You know, you look at them, they define themselves as a band of outlaws. Now, they probably don't go around doing as much killing as somebody the likes of the Hound or the Mountain or others we've seen. But, you know, given that this is a time of war, like who makes them, who makes Roller the decision maker in all this? And, you know, one other important point in this chapter that I'm sure we'll talk about now, I guess, is that we're introduced to the Lord of Light yet again, in albeit a very different way.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was an interesting way to mix it with what we know of him before.
Yeah.
Speaks for his case a little bit more, especially with Beric rising at the end of the chapter. It's like, I feel like George is trying to get us to convert to this Rollerism. Like, it's so convincing.
Yeah. It's a big contrast with Melisandre, because although we have seen the demon baby come out of her, and that seems to be evidence of Roller, there's something else about her that just kind of seems off. Like you don't really want to believe her because she seems so evil and she wants to give good people to the flames or whatever. But this Beric and Thoros, they're like, they seem much cooler and they seem much less susceptible to bullshit. So the fact that they can reincarnate after violent, gruesome, definitive death is kind of like, okay, there is something going on here.
Yeah, I remember talking about this in season three. Like, this was a game changer episode, because here's a man who was cleaved into, you know, from shoulder to breastplate or whatever, still survives. That means there actually is such a thing as well, something. This force that exists. Yeah, something there. Something. Whether it is the Lord of Light, whoever it is or whatever it is, definitely answers their calls as the Lord of Light. So why is this, like, what the hell? It absolutely changes everything, I think.
To be fair, I do want to mention that in the very beginning of this entire saga, at the very beginning of this entire tale, we did meet an undead ice person that was really good at fighting.
Yes.
So, I mean, yep. We've always had the mysticism. It's always been there. But when you've got Lem and Harwin, you know, Harwin who came in, remember when we celebrated all those weeks ago when Harwin basically kneeled and was like, holy crap, it's you, you know, like there's a Stark right in front of me. Like these are the people that we've over the weeks of travel, like we've been traveling and getting dirty with these guys. I feel like with the show, like we've come to trust and kind of admire in some ways. And you got Lem, you got Angai, Tom Seven Strings, and they're all chanting this prayer before the fight begins. Like Thoros is like, everybody bow your head. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it really adds an element to all that's happening. And like I said before, kind of mixes it with what Melisandre is doing. And does nothing but create more mystery while giving us more information. Yep.
It's so cool, though, that you brought that up because, you know, one instance is being brought back to life through ice, the other through fire. Mm. And fire, at least on the surface, you at least seem to have more of the personality of that individual there. It's certainly coming at a cost. That much is evident by just the appearance of Beric Dondarrion. Right. Whereas with the Whites, from what we've seen, there's no ability for that person to sort of think outside, kill, kill, kill all well, the time.
Who knows, honestly? Like, who knows what their
agenda is? Yeah, we don't
know.
We've never seen from a perspective of somebody who's been turned into a white. But yeah, this idea of sort of being, it's not even reincarnation. It's just being brought healed. Back from the dead, zombified in a way.
Like you're almost invulnerable and you have kind of super strength and a lot of different pluses, but you lose a lot of yourself. It's like there's a strange trade-off there.
Burns a lot of fat.
Yeah. And also,
no pun intended. Great
what fat Kate burner. Said too, Kate brought up a great point too, because you have kind of two sides of this religion now that you've seen in that Melisandre and her shadow vag baby, mm-hmm. and the way she conducts herself. And here you have Thoros of Myr and Beric Dondarrion. And for all we've heard of Thoros of Myr, like, he's a cool dude. Like, he used to drink Robert Baratheon under the table. So. Clearly, he's a badass. So what is it about this religion? I mean, is it just that these people were looking for something to grasp onto, something to rally around, some purpose that they could then utilize even in their justification for how they put, you know, the Hound on trial in this case? I think that could be the case. But, you know, this Lord of Light is starting to pop up a lot more now than we initially were aware of. And it's going to be interesting to follow, see if he or she or it shows its face anywhere else in the series.
To your point, Micah, and this was in the middle of this chapter, which again brings more variables to this question of the Lord of Light, and I think can be to blame for a lot of the allegiances in the room. Thoros is speaking, and he says, yet I am not the false priest you knew. He's having a back and forth with the Hound, who's like, dude, I know you. You're used to live in King's Landing, and you were definitely a bigger shithead than I've ever been, minus the killing of random people. Mm. And he's like, okay, sure, but yet I am not the false priest you knew. The Lord of Light has woken in my heart. Many powers long asleep are waking, and there are forces moving in the land. I have seen them in my flames.
There you go. You got a direct reference there to him looking into the flames for guidance, mm-hmm. which is exactly what Melisandre does.
And it's echoing all the things that we've heard out in Essos as well. And it's
about powers
what
being awakening.
What we've seen through the eyes of our point of view characters.
Magic.
Something. Damn it. Whatever the hell it is.
It's also a scary prospect, though, because we know that clearly somebody who practices the way that Thoros does can bring people back to life. You know, he brought Beric Dondarrion back this time, and we learn that he's done that before with him. Otherwise, there's no way that Beric would have sort of this, you know, enigma about him. You know, that this is where those stories come from that we hear so much about throughout, you know, the preceding chapters.
Speaking of seeing a legend happen, we just saw the Hound fight Beric Dondarrion with flaming swords, and oh man, Like that just happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'll be told.
It was great in the show.
And it was great in the book as well. I had such a great time with it.
It's really cool to see, even before the battle, right before the battle just begins, he's calling to his men and Arya notices there's like a scar or several scars. There's a black line along his neck. There's a spear hole, or basically from where a lance went all the way through him. Mm-hmm. These are clear, like, indicators or foreshadowing. It's like that he actually has been killed before. You know, any one of those blows was probably fatal. Every one of them probably was fatal, which is really badass in Ono. Well, I'll give an own here now first we do the Samwell chapter, of course. Samwell chapter own goes to Lord Commander Gior Mormont, whose dying wish is for his son to join the Night's Watch. That's his dying wish. And he tells Sam so much. And in fact, he prepares Sam in this chapter to do everything like that he himself would do if he survives. He tells Sam to go find more dragonglass and all this other stuff. And no doubt these ideas that Gior plants in Sam's head will become tactical plots in the future. So even though Old Bear didn't know he was dying, he gave Sam, a lot of things to think about and a lot of things to act on in the future. So, own to Gior.
Gior sounds like something a donkey would say.
Gior! Gior! Maybe.
Gior!
Sounds like something Clubfoot Carl would say after all that wine. Oh, man. This is a tough chapter. There was so much, like I said before, to put in. But I'm going to have to give my own to, what's this dude's name? To Ulmer, who is a wizened member of the Night's Watch, who was challenged by a younger man called Sweet Donal, who had laid a shaft just off the bullseye 50 yards away. And he's like, best that old man. And the reason this was all important, everyone was shouting. They're like, yeah, you hit the target, right? And he's like, I will. And so he steps forward and he's got this, you know, this whole deal. And there's stories about him being a famous outlaw in the Kingswood Brotherhood. And they're talking about how he claimed once and he put an arrow through the hand of the White Bull of the Kingsguard, still a kiss from the lips of a Dornish princess. It's just like, let's put some more adjectives in there. All right. He stole her jewels. He stole her chest of golden dragons. And all of this, you get laid out before him. And then, a la Robin Hood, he splits the shaft of Sweet Donald's arrow. And he's like, what? Will that do, lad? And I just thought, that was pretty damn good. So you get the own.
That is good.
Thank you, Kate.
Great own. I had a fun, just, it's his little interlude in this chapter is like two paragraphs long. But I had so much fun envisioning this whole Robin Hood lifestyle of the Kingswood Brotherhood. Like in just taking off into this short little mental story about Ulmer being this charming young lad stealing and wenching and all whatever, shooting his little arrows happily into the sunset and getting condemned to the Night's Watch for it. It's kind of like a disappointing end to that story.
He's still going though, you know.
Yeah,
it's like he's still going. Now he's helping the realm out. Yeah. Doesn't get much more honorable than that.
My own for the Samwell chapter goes to the steadfast and loyal Garens, who carried them from the fist and who became their supper.
Nothing goes better with horse flesh
than beer. Yeah, that's what we found out.
Now didn't Craster say that?
Yeah. He did.
That's
he
did. Who gets he did. My own for the Sam chapter.
That's how you transition right there. If you can't ride them, eat them. That's what I said.
That's right. That's what he says.
When did a blackbird ever bring good news to a man's hall? It's true. And it has a double meaning there because, of course, he's referring to the Night's Watch, the crows, but also the ravens as well.
Corn. That
Corn.
Raven's obsession with corn knows no bounds.
Corn.
I want to know.
It's really a secret acronym.
I don't blame him.
For Ronk.
Tell my son Jorah. Tell him, take the black.
Like you would condemn Jorah to this servitude for the realm. It's like, here's how you can redeem yourself, son. But he's already over across Anessos, you know, redeeming himself in his own way.
I didn't mean to change the subject there, but I just thought it was beautiful that he thought of Jorah as he was dying because he's a good guy, good dude. I'm sad that he's gone.
Me too.
He just had this one last badass chapter where he's like barking orders at the top of his saddle, just getting it. He kind of reminds me of the mayor from Majora's Mask, the mayor of Clocktown. if anyone is listening and knows that reference, he just kind of reminds you of just yelling orders at people. No, not the mayor. The guy, like the head of the carpenters that's yelling at the mayor. You guys understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Coming with you on this.
Sorry.
Yeah. So I don't know. I question whether or not my own for the Arya chapter will be shared with each of you. It should be. Because it's badass. My own goes to the Hound. Not only does he, I mean, yes, for winning, but also because right after he wins, and this battle between him and Dondarrion goes on for pages and pages, and it's like Arya is counting specifically how many steps forward the Hound takes and how many steps backward he takes. It's crazy intense. But after he wins and his arm is all burned and like pieces of flesh are just sliding off of it, he is on the ground crying. And he's asking for help. Here's the quote. "Please," Sandor Clegane rasped, cradling his arm. Cradling. "Please," Sandor Clegane rasped, cradling his arm. "I'm burned. Help me. Someone help me." He was crying. "Please." Here's a man who is just, he's over. He's like, "I won this battle. Like, just come and help me now. Okay, this is over. I did what you made me do. I'm done. Yeah. I won. Suck it. Also, please help me." He's crying. And I'm like, it takes a man to cry. Definitely does. To ask for help.
Certainly in this case.
Especially, yeah, who was just their prisoner. So, yeah, own to the Hound.
My own goes to Arya.
What now?
You know what? That's fair because she's barely in this chapter.
When she just says, "Rulor? I don't even know what that is."
That was good.
There you go.
My own goes to the Hound, just for the verbal sparring this entire chapter. Like I said, it's not like he was compensating for anything. He truly was just dumbfounded at the incredulousness of these men. He was just like, "What are you guys talking about? You drug me into this tree cave. I ran from the Lannisters so long ago." And then they give him this big spiel. I'll leave out most of it. I'll spare you their gallantry. But they were like, "We're brothers here," Thoros Samir declared. "Holy brothers sworn to the realm, to our god, and to each other. The brotherhood without banners." Tom Sevenstrings plucked a string. And someone's like, "The Knights of Hollow Hill." And he's like, "Knights?" Clegane made the word a sneer. "Dondarrion's a knight, but the rest of you are the sorriest lot of outlaws and broken men I've ever seen. Shit better men than you."
That's a very out of fucking chickens line.
My own for this chapter goes to Rollar, who seems to not be full of shit.
Yeah.
There is something there.
I don't know what's up with Rollar, but there's something there.
He's just blading by on his rollerblades. But now we have owns from our listeners.
Do we?
We do.
We do.
Took a break from there. From their fruitcake and send us some owns.
Yeah. Thanks for stepping away from the fruitcake, guys. You own.
Thank you guys at home. I know a lot of our listeners are probably baking dozens and dozens of cookies for their family or
God, I love cookies.
God, I love the screaming.
Oh, fuck. I'm going to bake the fuck out of some cookies.
Yeah. So before we get to our own baking, why don't we, I was going to say something about cooking up their owns, but. We can just read them.
Let's get baked and read some owns.
Let's get baked and read some owns.
Yes. Let's go on over to Facebook first.
Facebook.
Ah, where people have scrawled upon our wall.
They have.
With quill and ink.
First, we heard from Lanny Anzavino, who said, "The own for Sam chapter goes to the Lord Commander's Raven, whose relentless squawking for corn contributed to, if not caused, Carl to snap, causing the rebellion at Craster's."
That's a good point.
I agree, that's one annoying bird. Own to Arya chapter goes to Paul Kay, the actor who plays Thoros of Myr in the show. He really brought the character to life, and I'm always reminded of that whenever I reread these chapters Thoros appears in. Props to Paul Kay for an inspired performance.
I agree.
Next own is from Christina Klein, who says, "This Sam chapter owned me." Thanks, Uncle Ray. "The moments of both Craster and Mormont's deaths made me gasp out loud and get mouthy at the book. Yes, I was that girl in the corner talking back to the book's author. What are you doing? And Beric Dondarrion sitting in the tangle of weirwood roots in the Brotherhood's cave, all gloriously reborn several times over. And stuff. I can say no more. My mind is blown. It is owned."
It is blown.
Mike Burns. Here's another own.
Let me
try this again.
Got this.
My mind is also blown. I shall repair it with an own for Mike Burns. He says, here are my owns for Seminaria. For Sam's chapter, I give it to Gior Mormont for his reply to Sam, saying the watch could take Gilly's baby. He says, we need a newborn babe to care for near much as we need more snow. Do you have milk to feed him in those big tits of yours? Or do you mean to take the mother too? And for Arya, I give it to the Hound for all of his killer insults, like this one. Dondarrion, we are the Forgotten Fellowship. The Hound, send me on my way and I'll forget you too.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's nicely done, Mike. Burn.
Nicholas Hartley, it looks like, wrote us an email, as is his wont. Thank you, Nicholas Hartley.
Thank you.
He says, my own for Samwell goes to Clubfoot Carl. I hate how the events at Craster's keep unfolded, but I can appreciate and understand him calling out Craster. A man can only be kicked while he's down so many times and be told the man doing the kicking is doing him a favor.
I'm sorry.
Winters are hard and long north of the wall. Had he not been so arrogant in his position and confident that the Lord Commander could keep these desperate men in line, no one would have died.
Mm-hmm.
My own for Arya goes to the Hound, Sandor Clegane. He fears only one thing, the flames. Yet he manages to push through that fear when he needed to most in order to slay Lord Beric and earn his freedom. I also like how he doesn't fall prey to the hypocrisy of the brothers in thinking that someone they are any better or different than he is. Men commit atrocities in times of war. The side you're fighting for doesn't wash them away. It's a good point.
It is.
I'd also like to let Zach know that while I appreciate him trying to play internet love connection, I only sew with Mrs. Hartley, and her name isn't Nicole.
Nick Hartley does not sew.
Nick Hartley does not sew.
You tried, Zach. You tried. It was all in good faith.
Our final owns come from Oisin Doyle over on Twitter, who said, my own for the Sam chapter goes to Old Bear for the line... Do you have milk to feed them in those big tits of yours?
Rude.
And my own for the Arya chapter goes to the Hound for the line, quote, if he couldn't fuck it, fight it, or drink it, it bored him. Referring to Robert, of course. That's a really good line.
I think it's a pretty good description of Robert.
But in addition to owns, we did receive some funny and interesting comments, remarks, photos, things from our followers. We want to thank you for that. Namely, Bevan Boychuk tweeted at us a little bit ago and just said, updated my Game of Thrones shelf, and it includes...
Everything.
It's like every one of those Pop Funko miniatures. Thingies.
Who's on the Iron Throne? Is that Ned?
That's Rob, I think.
Looks like Tyrion to me.
No, it's Rob.
He looks surly.
He looks very surly. I did not know there was a ghost pop vinyl.
Yeah, it's kind of furry, too. The one they sold at Comic-Con is kind of furry.
Oh, jeez.
Look at Drogo and his Arrak. Look at him. He's like, I'll kill you, Bran of Tarth. And another version of me. This is pretty badass spread.
This is a good collection of objects. Thank you.
And then we've got one from Colton, who also sent us a photograph of a shelf of things. And he says, is my girlfriend the best girlfriend ever? It is known. And it looks like that she got him a nice spread of deliciousness, aka some maps of the lands of Westeros and other things that I can't read. I don't have my contacts on.
The Game of Thrones books and shit.
Yeah.
And nice.
Some scrolls.
It is gorgeous. The Lady Ash has sent two tweets and they go out, it looks like, to everyone.
Mm.
The first one says, happy holidays to all my fellow Goo listeners and the Goo hosts. Celebrate love, family, friends, community, and fandom. Oh. She like stole our thunder.
Yeah, we were going to wish everybody happy holidays. Gosh.
She goes on to say, if all men or women but serve, you guys do it best. You unite us listeners and fandom, and that is truly a great gift. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That was super nice.
That's so nice.
Very nice.
I guess she said it better than we could.
She did.
Yeah.
So those are all the ways that you can get in touch with us, Facebook, email, and Twitter.
Facebook.com/GameOfOwns, Twitter.com/GameOfOwns, and contact@GameOfOwns.com, respectively.
You took it out of sequence.
Did I?
Yeah.
Then not respectively. irrespectively.
Any order. I hope you guys all have fantastic holidays. This is going to be, I think, coming out just before Christmas or in the midst of Hanukkah or just after a few days after the solstice. But I hope that even if you're doing none of the above, that you are surrounded by warmth and happiness and warm glows and stiff drinks.
And people that you love.
Happy future Kwanzaa.
I think we'll probably have one more episode, right, before the year wraps. And
I think so.
Be sure to also, since it is the year 2014 and nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable, head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rate and review. We do look forward to your feedback. I know we have a few there that have yet to be read, but we're still awaiting a few more. We need to compile a list, and as the year comes to a close, read your feedback over on iTunes. You know, as we head into 2015 and season 5 being not that far away, we know that there'll be some people who are interested in learning about what else is out there, you know, and we are what else is out there. So
that's us.
One of those
that's
people.
Us.
We appreciate it. We appreciate all the people who've reviewed the show over the course of the last year, all the people who've sent in tweets and Facebook posts and emails and all other things imaginable.
And I just want to say to you guys, couldn't ask for a better Christmas recording. This is so fun. Thank you for being my friends and all of us doing this together.
Yeah.
And to the listeners for spending some of their Christmas week with us, their holiday week thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of you.
If anybody gets any Game of Thrones related Christmas presents, make sure to tweet them at us.
Yes.
We do.
We always like to see what you guys get and buy it for ourselves afterwards.
Live vicariously through you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to get any Game of Thrones presents, but we'll see. I certainly gave some out. Sorry about all the confetti, people. I'm not sorry. I hope your carpets stay shiny for years. Hey, Sam, do you want to end the show with a song?
Of course I do.
That's not Sam. Mike, get out of here. Oh. We need Sam.
Of course I do.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We love you. Where's Sam?
Hi.
Hi, Sam.
Hello, Eric. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Sam.